Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talk Team Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination, and you're invited along. We'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. It is Talking Twilight Zone. I'm your host, Lynn, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Bobby and Dave, and today it's Rick Wall, who is always here. We love Rick Wall. And Robert is not here with us today. He has some family business to tend to, and he will be adding his comments later on.
Yes, hello, everybody. I'm Robert, and through the magic of editing, I will be leaving my reviews shortly for you to listen to. So until that time, please enjoy the show.
But today, we're going to be doing two episodes. I'm Night Color Me Black, and The Sounds and the Silences. So I'm going to turn it over to Dave for an opening clip for I'm Night Color Me Black.
I don't know, Deputy. It's 7:30 in the morning, and it's pitch black outside. Tell you the truth, I don't know why. I don't know why at all.
Sheriff Charlie Kutch. On the morning of an execution. As a matter of fact, it's 7:30 in the morning. Logic and natural laws dictate that at this hour there should be daylight. It is a simple rule of physical science that the sun should rise at a certain moment and supersede the darkness. But at this given moment, Sheriff Charlie Kutch, a deputy named Pierce, a condemned man named Jagger, and a small, inconsequential village will shortly find out that there are causes and effects that have no precedent. Such is usually the case in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, such as usually is the case in the Twilight Zone. That's for sure. I'm not even going to go into synopsis of this one. Basically, it's a man who's being executed, and during the time that he's executed, or set to be executed, I should say, it turns night, and it stays night into the daytime, and nobody can understand it. It's everywhere except, it's daylight everywhere except in this little town. And the man's name is Jagger, and he's soon to be hanged. And as usual, curious crowds are gathering with no clue as to why it's still dark. And when the prisoner is finally brought to the gallows, he refuses to apologize for the murder he committed, and then the crowd becomes angry. They want this man hung. He murdered someone. Suddenly, a black minister approaches Jagger and thanks him for defending black people, but he wants to know if Jagger enjoyed killing the guy. And Jagger said he did, and then he's hung. At this point, the darkness gets thicker and blacker. The minister believes it's all due to the hatred that everyone's feeling for Jagger. Back at the sheriff's station, a radio announcer reports that other episodes of darkness are occurring in various parts of the world, such as the Berlin Wall, Dealey Plaza in Dallas, North Vietnam, etc., etc. There's a lot of heavy dialogue in this episode, and personally, I thought it dragged a little bit. Two other Twilight Zone episodes, Execution and Dust, they dealt with hangings too. In those two episodes, the convicts escaped their hangings due to divine intervention. In this episode, the hanging went off as planned. Now, I thought the acting was decent. I've always liked Michael Constantine. He was one of the stars of it. And Ivan Dixon, he was one of the stars, and he's a very good actor. And this was his second Zone appearance. And he was in Big Tall Wish from the first season. There was also Paul Fix, and I'm not very familiar with his work or the work of Terry Becker, but they played their parts well. George Lindsay, he's best known for his role as Goober in the Andy Griffith Show. And that's the way I always remember him. But I really wasn't crazy about this episode, so I don't have a whole lot to say about it. And I'm giving it a 1.5 for the acting mostly. It was not a memorable episode for me. So I'm going to leave it at a 1.5.
Here's my review for I Am the Night Colored Me Black. Pretty much a simple story of a man convicted and hung and the permanent darkness that sets in on a small town. This episode very much reminds me of the season 4 story He's Alive about evil personified in the ghost of Hitler. This was Serling's statement on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Also, a salute was done in season 1 of the television show called Under the Dome, based on a book written by Stephen King. King said that he has had watched The Twilight Zone in the past, so you can see how the last episode of season 1, Under the Dome, used the idea of a man being hung and not being guilty of anything, so to say, but being framed for murders that happened in that series. Also, The Twilight Zone is talked about in season 2, episode 1, which was written by King himself. Of course, well-known Michael Constantine, he was in the TV series Room 222. He was also in numerous TV shows and made guest appearances in numerous TV shows, and also appeared in an episode of Friday the 13th, the series, about a cursed pipe. And I believe he played Ryan's father in that episode. I'm not for sure, but I think he did. For me, it was an okay story. With more talk, less action. My rating is a 2 out of 5. And let's get back to the show.
And I'm going to turn it over to Bobby.
Okay. I believe that Paul Fix was in the series The Rifleman. He was the sheriff in town. This episode, aside from being agonizingly slow and boring, is there's something worse going on here. And that's that it's a real missed opportunity to make a really good episode. Could have been, because it's dark and brooding and kind of scary, all the things that The Twilight Zone is known for. But they all really get lost because it's obvious that Rod Serling, who wrote this episode, is trying to deliver a message, a personal message. We're near the end of the series, and I guess he felt this was his last opportunity to do that, because it's such an extraordinary anti-capital punishment message, it's about as heavy-handed as it can be. Now, of course, that annoys me to begin with, because I support the death penalty, always have and always will, and I think it's nonsense to believe that if you go through with the death penalty, you're just as bad as the person who committed the crime. That's ridiculous, to my mind. There are a lot of people who are really opposed to it, and it looks to me, just from this episode alone, like Rod Serling was one of them, because it is extremely heavy-handed. I mean, just because this man gets executed, the whole world goes dark. Well, what about all the executions that came before him? How come the world didn't go dark then? Now it is. So that doesn't make any sense right there. But what I wanted to know was whether this is not just an episode, but this is a statement by Rod Serling. And I've never read anything about him as far as his feelings on that subject. He was an anti-war activist. He was in the war, but he was very much opposed to it. So I Googled this question asking whether Rod Serling really was opposed to the death penalty in a vocal way or in his writing. And I found 3 biographies on the internet that are very interesting. I've never seen them before. And I'm going to post them on the board at the Twilight Zone Revisited and Reviewed over the weekend for people to read. Because even though we know a lot about him, these points of view are very interesting. In one of the articles, I found the following paragraph. This is not written by me. This is written by another person. And it says, Serling quickly realized that to get a point across often meant creating scripts that contained controversial messages and dialogues. Corporate sponsors, on the other hand, had no desire to have their products matched with messages that might be deemed offensive. In 1959, Serling expressed his frustration.
And he said, quote, "I think it is criminal that we are not permitted to make dramatic note of social evils that exist, of controversial themes as they are inherent in our society," end of quote. Because of the hostile creative environment, Serling began to see the advantages of writing science fiction and fantasy. He learned that advertisers would routinely approve stories, including controversial situations, if they took place on fictional worlds. Out of this realization came the television series The Twilight Zone, on which Serling and other writers would enjoy unprecedented artistic freedom. And that's the end of that paragraph. And I think you see that in this episode right here, because he could have simply written a script about the death penalty, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. And instead, he had the whole world go dark, so it has a science fiction feel to it. So after reading this, and I only came across this about a day of an hour ago, I think that's really the point of this whole episode. He's making very much a statement here. He may be making statements in other stories too, but this is about as heavy-handed as I've ever seen this series be. And it's just, it does have good acting in it. I gave it a 1 just because of the acting. And it is certainly interesting to see George Lindsay Goober in a dramatic role. That certainly is not something that you see every day. But it's too slow, and it's too depressing. And it's just, you know, I mean, it could have used Opie and Andy and Floyd and Ann B in it to brighten it up a little bit.
Oh, Andy!
But I think, yeah, she could have said that right as the guy was being hanged. And but I, having read this now, I think that it's obvious that Serling was very, very much opposed to the death penalty, because the whole world has to go dark. This episode also reminds me a little bit of The Midnight Sun, where the world is doomed, only in that case it was about temperatures, and here it's about light and dark. So it's just kind of strange. I think it is a missed opportunity, because it's the kind of really, you know, scary story that makes for a good Twilight Zone, but it's too heavy-handed. Serling should have lightened the message up a little bit and not gone so much with his own opinion. I think it's obvious that we only got a few stories to go. He wanted to get that out there, and he did. And this paragraph I just read shows that, you know, sponsors, and today it's much more liberal, but back then, you know, they didn't want anything associated with their product that people would not like. And there's always been a lot of debate about the death penalty, whether it's good or bad. And he managed to get, this guy who wrote this is right, he managed to get around it by saying, well, look, this is just science fiction. The world's not going to go dark. It's just, you know, it's a fantasy. But he got that message across. Unfortunately, it's not terribly entertaining. I gave it a 1, and I'll stick with that. Lynn?
Okay. And Dave?
Okay, yeah, it was a little bit leaden and heavy-handed. I agree. I'm surprised, Lynn, you haven't heard of the actor Paul Fix, but he did mainly, as Bobby's already said, with The Rifleman. He appeared in a lot of cowboy movies. So if cowboys are not your thing, you may not have come across him as much. But he certainly was in, if you look at his page on Wikipedia, the amount of stuff he's been in, you know, he's a real, you know, journeyman, a real character actor. And
right.
I think his portrayal of the hack writer for the local paper that basically had, given up. In fact, the whole town seemed to have given up. And I think there were some mixed messages in this story, because at first when it started, there was a bit heavy-handed in terms of, like, this was a judgment on the town, and there was some element of this man wasn't guilty. You know, the powder burns on the thing, it may be the gun had gone off in a struggle or whatever, and it seemed to be pointing that it was an unjust hanging. Like Bobby said, it wasn't a lynch mob. I mean, all right, they were baying for blood at the end, the crowd, but the man had his trial, he'd had his day in court. So it wasn't the fact of an injustice was going on here, although they seemed to set that scene up at the beginning with this man. And in fact, the accused man didn't help himself the way it was written, in as much as he seemed to be saying, well, if you think I'm guilty, then I'm guilty, you know, go with the majority. I mean, that word go with the majority was echoed on three or four of the actual different conversations during the course. So I'm not quite sure, because they did a switcheroo at the end when we get to the actual hanging event, that the chap changes his tune and said, yeah, actually, I did do it, you know, and almost then he was accusing them that they're just as bad as him, you know. I killed somebody, now I'm going to pay the penalty. You're going to kill me, you're going to pay the penalty.
Right.
And that didn't sit right. It seemed archaic somewhat as well, but I'm sure it was absolutely right for the time, where when the religious man, the vicar, you know, said, you know, we're not of the same religion and we're not the same colour. I thought that was, you know, something that wouldn't have got pointed out, I don't think, now. Basically, you know, why should a black man in this case defend this white man? I'll try and get this white man into heaven by presumably getting him to confess his sins.
Because he killed the guy who killed five black people.
Right, right, yeah. So I suppose that was the racial element into it. But I suppose it's the time that it was set. But I did think it was rather pedestrian in the way it was directed. And what a cheap clock tower. That clock tower must have been of all the 4 foot high, the cheapest cardboard looking clock tower I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Yep.
I suppose all the money went on all the extras that they had in the out of town. So it was a little bit leaden. According to the wiki page on this, the impetus behind the story was relating to the assassination of President Kennedy. Whether you take what wiki says. Well, it says that Sterling wrote the script primarily as his personal reaction to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which, of course, was only a few months earlier, because this was, this, by the way, obviously, is episode 146 in Series 5, and it aired on the 27th of March, 1964. So he would have been writing this at the end of 63, mm-hmm. After the assassination.
And that's why, at the end, they had to go dark in Dealey Plaza.
And again, it seemed to be shifting sounds, this, because, first of all, when they were saying, well, you know, they made a few points that it was only dark over this one town. So I'm thinking, well, that's not so much. It's a dead town anyway. If I was a newspaper man, I'd think, right, I'm going to set my newspaper up in another town. You know, the dark's not going to follow me. And then, of course, we have the change. So to me, this wasn't very well written. The sand's shifting all the way through this, and you're not sure whether to think this is an unjust hanging, that it actually was a case of self-defense with one of the things. It was a weak story. I don't think the actual directing was very good either, and that's a surprise, because the Abner Biedermann, who's only directed one other Twilight Zone episode, that was The Dummy, which actually was quite a good story, I thought. That was the one with Cliff Robinson, you know, the ventriloquist dummy one, which might echo what was going to come in a week or two. But anyway, the only good scene that I thought I saw in this one that showed any sort of spark of direction was all the bravado that this man that was about, you know, I'll dance on the jib for you, I'll entertain you, sort of, you know, riling against the crowd and defiant. And then he turns on the steps, and there's a lovely little cameo, because the cameraman shoots his face through the hoop of the rope, through the actual noose of the hope, the rope.
Yeah, that was...
And then he's transferred. But that, to be frank, in a 25-minute episode, was the only, you know, really good thing. There was some good acting by the other ensemble cast. As I say, I thought Paul Fix, the writer, played the best part. I thought the chap who played the actual man to be hanged did quite a decent job in his cell. But all in all, I think even I can only give it 2, because it was long-winded. I mean, I've spoken out before that it doesn't always have to be action. But I think the actual dialogue was confused as well. So the dialogue can't carry it for me in this case because of those confusing episodes. And I'll hand back to you, Lynn.
Okay, Rick.
Okay, first of all, yes, it is sort of against capital punishment, but it's more against racism. Is it preachy?
Yeah.
Is it slow? Yeah. But Rod tends to get that way.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with it, really. I like it, as a matter of fact. Was the killer a good man? No, he killed other people, too. He was a drunk. Yeah, okay, fine. But, who was the worst scum, him or the guy he killed? In my opinion, the guy he killed.
Right.
As for why did places get dark, actually, North Vietnam was the first one, I believe. And do you know why? Because in Asia, they're very, like the Nazis, very pure-oriented. I forget the word that's, I can't think of it right now. But, they don't like mixed races and stuff like that. They're very racist.
Who did you say is very racist?
Asian.
A bit of a sweeping statement.
It is, but it's true, David. What did South Korea and even North Korea do with the Amerasians that came out of the Korean War? Killed most of them.
But still sweeping. I mean, it's not as though you've talked to every one of them to ask them if they all think the same.
The governments are. Maybe not the people, but the governments are, David.
Well, that's a qualification anyway, yeah.
Let's see. I'd probably give it a 3.
A 3? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Just because it's a little too preachy for me.
Okay, so we've got 1 and 1.5 and a 2 and a 3. Okay, cool. Wait, Bobby, what did you give it?
1.
Okay, so 2 ones and a 2 and a 3. All right. Okay, awesome.
Darkness continues to make itself known.
A sickness known as hate. Not a virus, not a microbe, not a germ. But a sickness nonetheless. Highly contagious. Deadly in its effects. Don't look for it in the twilight zone. Look for it in the mirror. Look for it before the light goes out altogether.
I love his closing narrations. Okay, I do. I love the closing narration. Okay, my next episode is called The Sounds and the Silences, starring John MacGyver. And I'll go over to Dave for the opening clip for that one.
One of these days, all that noise is going to come back and bite him. I hope I'm around to see it happen.
This is Roswell G. Flemington. 220 pounds of gristle, lung tissue, and sound decibels. He is, as you have perceived, a noisy man. One of a breed who substitutes volume for substance, sound for significance, and shouting to cover up the readily apparent phenomena that he is nothing more than an overweight and aging perennial sea scout whose noisemaking is in inverse ratio to his competence and to his character. But soon our would-be admiral of the fleet will embark on another voyage. This one is an uncharted and twisting stream that heads for a distant port called the Twilight Zone.
Okay, well, I have a very short synopsis for this one. A model ship magnate, he thunders about his home and office until his ears play tricks on him. Roswell Flemington, he was raised in a home where he couldn't even have cookies because cookies made too much noise. But at least his mother bought brownies. So when he came of age, he went to sea. And his desire to compensate for not making enough noise is driving everyone else crazy. He's collected all sorts of nautical noisemakers, bells, whistles, and actual recordings of sea battles. One day, after 20 years, his wife has had enough of his obsession with noise, and she finally divorces him. Shortly after, every little noise is like an explosion, and then he sees a doctor who helps him understand that the conflict with his wife has caused him to relive his resentment against his mother to the point that he internalizes his mother's affection. Or, I'm sorry, his mother's affliction, not affection. Her affliction. And then he now realizes that it's all in his head, and all he needs to do is overcome the mental block with mind over matter. And he does. The only problem is that when his wife returns to pick up her jewelry, he tells her about it, and he proceeds to shut her out. Then he goes too far in the other direction, and now he can't hear anything at all. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that episode, oh, boy. That was one of Rod's biggest duds. I mean, this jackass, Flemington, he decides to drive his wife crazy with all his nautical obsession and blaring recordings of battles and bells and who cares, whatever else. And the point is that he was an obnoxious jerk. He was totally obnoxious. His wife finally had enough of him, and she left, which should not be a big surprise, other than the fact that she was married to him for 20 years.
Excuse me, Lynn, for a second. Sure. Speaking of sure. Enough, what I told you about before, I got to go. My eyes are running. My nose.
Oh, sure.
Sure. Garbage.
No, you go. You go rest.
Yeah, thank you.
Hope you feel better.
Show if I'm still alive, as I told you before.
I hope you feel better, hon. I really do.
All right. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Yeah, I wish the best for Rick. He's not feeling well. Hope he doesn't get the flu. But anyway, Flemington's wife dumps him, and his hearing gets insanely sensitive, so he goes to a shrink who tells him that it's all in his head. And then when his wife shows up again, he uses his mind control to make her voice so low that eventually he can't hear anything. Now, I have one question. Does anybody give a rat's ass about this guy or this story? I mean, actually, there is no story. This might very well be the worst episode of Series 5, but there's actually an episode that I hate even more than this one, and we haven't gotten to it yet. But when we do, I'll be ranting about how much I detest that one. But anyway, back to the story, non-story. It's stupid, and it's useless. It leaves you feeling nothing, nothing at all. What's even worse is John MacGyver's horrible overacting. I mean, I thought this whole episode sucked. MacGyver's character is actually more irritating than Mr. Beavis or Bartlett Finchley from A Thing About Machines. Rod Serling had to know what a load of garbage this episode was, but he didn't really care anymore since I guess he knew the end of the series was very near, and it's a shame that his name has to be connected with this, but at least it's so forgettable that most people won't remember that Rod wrote it. It has no substance whatsoever. It stunk to the highest level, and it gets the biggest zero from me. So, Bobby, what do you have to say about it?
Well, it's obvious that John MacGyver was handpicked for this episode because what you've got here is another situation that you had with Wally Cox. I mean, he made a career out of being irritating and annoying and listening to his voice. I mean, there's no question about that. And he died. He was only 61 when he died. And it says at Wikipedia that he made over 100 appearances in television and motion pictures over two decades. He also did commercials. He did commercials for Baggies, which I don't remember, and for American Express, which I also don't remember. I probably turned the TV off when that came on. They also call him an owl-faced, portly actor with a mid-Atlantic accent. That's funny. I'm from the mid-Atlantic, and I don't talk that way. At least I don't think so. So I don't know what that mid-Atlantic accent is all about. But he made a career out of that. He made a career out of being really annoying. So here he is in an episode in which he can't stand anything he hears, because the viewers can't stand anything they're hearing either, especially from him. So I don't think that was just coincidence that he's in here. I think he's in here because somebody was giving a message here. And he knew he was annoying, and he made a career out of it. You got to give him that. Well, you know, you make out with whatever you have. Personally, any time he was on the screen, I ran the other way. because he never acted any differently. However, he was married to his wife for 28 years until he died, and they had 10 children, 10, count them, 10. 10 children, which means, I suppose, that with the lights out and their clothes off, he wasn't quite as irritating as he was when he was on the screen.
Unless you did it to shut him up.
I might have done that myself. So, I mean, that's the worst part of the episode. And Lynn is, of course, right. It's totally pointless. And it's like too many other season 5 episodes. This seems to have no purpose except to be irritating. And I don't watch, well, I watch TV today, and I'm irritated constantly. But back then, I didn't watch TV to be irritated, and this is just an irritating episode. It's just beyond the pale, but it belongs in season 5. It doesn't really surprise me any that it's here. And Lynn's right. There's really nothing to say about it, because if he can't stand everything he hears, he needs to get lost. Don't bring it to me, and don't make me suffer along with him. I gave it a 0. In fact, everybody gave it a 0 at the group, including Robert. So I'm really sorry he's not here today, because Robert very rarely, if ever, gives a 0 to anything, but he did to this. And if I give it a 0, everybody, Rick would say, well, business as usual. But when Robert gives it a 0, you know it's really, really bad. Lynn?
That's true.
Hello, everybody. I'm back with my review of Sounds and Silences. Well, it was not hard to give this one a 0 if you compared it to The Bard, which you can compare really bad episodes to. And it's true, I rarely give a 0 because my belief is that if Rod put it on The Twilight Zone, then, you know, it's worth at least a 1. But unfortunately, the way I felt about this episode should have sunk to the bottom of the sea to Davy Jones' locker, never to be found again. This story was an insult to our senses, including our hearing. The lesson I learned from this is don't play your music too loud, or years down the road you'll go deaf. It was quite boring to listen to an old blowhard whining and complaining about when he was a kid he couldn't make loud noises. So later on, when he owned his model shop, he decided to take it out on everyone, including his wife, and I can't understand how she would hang around for as long as she did. Why she didn't leave him years ago is kind of a surprise to me. But please, no more of this episode ever again. My rating, as Bobby said, was a 0, like everybody else on the Talking Twilight Zone board there. Let's hope this episode stays buried for a long, long time. Now, back to everyone at Talking Twilight Zone.
Okay, Dave.
Yeah, no, I can't say a lot about it. I mean, you're quite right. The actor, John MacGyver, might have done 100 appearances, but one performance, the same performance. But, I mean, referring to the Wally Cox, I sometimes think, I mean, we hear nowadays with new actors and new performances, people who have their career planned out, you've only got to think like, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, who's so scared of being typecast as Harry Potter, that the
right.
First three films he did after Harry Potter, you know, he played like a murderer or a seductionist or a, you know, Equus or whatever it was, as bizarre things he did. Same thing as the guy who played the Hobbit in the Lord of the Rings series. The first thing I saw him in after that was in Sin City, where he played a mass murderer, you know, to go completely out of type. So I think it can become a trap, and let's face it, maybe easy money. I mean, if there was a few like that. I mean, there was I seem to remember when I've watched some documentaries about TVs, they were sort of they need an English gent. In fact, no, I know what it was. It was the film The Sting with Robert Redford and
Paul Newman.
Yeah, but when they were doing the sting, they called up people who actually played a character. So they wanted somebody who played as, you know, a British buffoon, and somebody want this and that. And these people had their sort of, they looked through a book, and they, if you wanted a British buffoon, that was the actor you got. If you wanted an upper class twit, that's the actor you got. If you wanted a down and out tramp, you got that one. And basically, they must have been in Hollywood with the amount of films and TV shows they were churning out. I mean, let's face it, you only have to look at this man's career. and I'm laughing here because he's been on hundreds of different shows, but he's never been on the same show twice. You know, basically, they needed somebody.
I wonder why.
Well, exactly. You know, because that was it. He had one role. He did it. He took his $1,000 and went, you know, went off and made children. So, I mean, So that was it. So I can't. But
he usually plays like a cranky old guy. He usually plays a crank.
Yeah, I don't know how early this was in his career. He's like you said, he was. Well, now when was he born? I think I've just closed his page up. Let me have a look. Oh, he's born.
He always plays a grouchy
1913.
Guy.
So he's already, you know, quite old. He'd been playing the same character all his
a
life.
Curmudgeon.
Yeah. Yeah, I am going to give the episode 1 point, however, and I'm going to give it for his long-suffering wife. I thought the actress Penny Singleton played his wife. Mm-hmm. I thought she played a good role. She, you know, she finally lost her patience, and there was at least a good stand-up row between the two. And I hadn't realised it because I don't really watch it, but she was famous for playing. Are voicing a cartoon called Blondie.
Blondie and Dagwood,
yeah. Yeah, there was an original movie called Blondie, but then there's about 20 more. Blondie Meets the Boss, Blondie Invitation, Blondie and Budget, Blondie Cloopid, Blondie's Holiday, Blondie's Holiday. Yeah. And she did that from 1938 up till 1950 with Beware of Blondie. So, in effect, she made a career out of one role. Yeah, you could see that she was an actress. I thought she played, you know, I thought she was the only thing that really held my interest, the only person, should I say, that held my interest in it whatsoever. But it was an annoying episode. You knew where it was going. It was a retread, wasn't it, of the series where, you know, we had that one episode where there's a man who couldn't stand everybody, so the curse was that everybody in the world looked like him. And we had other stories like that where people, you know, wish something and they basically got it. He wished not to hear this woman, and therefore the one thing that gave meaning to his life, the noise, the sound of his seascapes and his things, was then deprived of him. So it was a come up thing. So I am just going to give it a one. But you know, the longer this Talking Twilight Zone, I mean, if we went to another 20 or 30 episodes, which I know we're not, I'd be getting very much into Bobby's corner, I think. So maybe it's just as well that we're coming to the end of the series.
Yeah, we are, yeah.
And
I have one thing to add that I forgot to mention. His wife's name was Ruth, and her maiden name was Shemelsky. I can't even say it. Shemelsky. Shemelsky.
Shemelsky.
So things could be worse. I call myself Bobby Neer, but I think from now on I'll be Bobby Shmigelsky. So we get to the end of the series.
Bobby Shmigelsky.
Yes, well, that would be good. Just call me Bobby Shmigelsky.
So when you've reprised our ratings, I'll play the outro to that one.
Okay, so we have 2 zeros and a 1, and you can do the outro.
No, actually, I gave it a -10. Actually.
Come on, let's hear it! What? Barrackin, what was that?
He gave it a -10. He gave it a 1. Go ahead.
In my written review, I gave it a -10. You can go look at it. It's there.
Okay, here we go.
All right.
Come on, let's hear it! Louder!
When last heard from, Mr. Roswell G. Flemington was in a sanitarium, pleading with the medical staff to make some noise. They, of course, believed the case to be a rather tragic aberration, a man's mind becoming unhinged, And for this, they're all given pills, therapy, and rest. Little do they realize that all Mr. Flemington is suffering from is a case of poetic justice. Tonight's tale of sounds and silences from the Twilight Zone.
Yo, Adrian! I did it!
And poetic justice it was. Okay, well, we'll be back in 2 weeks. And watch, we'll be back on Valentine's Day, February 14th. And we'll be doing Caesar and Me. And, oops, I forgot the other one. The Jeopardy Room, right?
Yeah.
Caesar and Me and the Jeopardy Room.
Oh,
two more winners. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so until then, folks, thank you, Bobby. Thank you, Dave. And I will see you both in 2 weeks. And hopefully Rick will be feeling better by then, and Robert will be back. Okay, see you then.
Bye.
Bye.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Next time out in the Twilight Zone, we move into a very dark corner of the odd and the unpredictable with a story called Caesar and Me. It's written by Adele T. Strassfield, and it stars one of the most talented young men on the acting scene today, Jackie Cooper. Here's one that may stay with you after the lights are out. It's a story of a ventriloquist and his dummy. And this one is designed for the cold chills and the hot fevers.